finally, I said, I'll tell you what. Give up cheese for 2 weeks before the next blood test. Just 2 weeks. You can do it. He said, okay, yeah, you're right. I can do that for 2 weeks. Comes back. His small, dense LDLs plummet. His oxidized LDL is now normal for the first time in several years. And he looks at it and he says, wow, it's the cheese. And I said, yeah, you know, light bulbs go out. Great. You get it. He says, you know, this is great news. I said, oh, you know, thank goodness we're getting through. He said, I just have to give up cheese for 2 weeks before every blood test, and you'll never know.
Welcome to the Fat Emperor podcast. I'm your host, Ivor Cummins. We're supported by the Irish Heart Disease Awareness Charity, which advocates a simple CT scan to reveal your CAC score. So know your score and take action to prevent that premature heart attack. Everything you need to know will be right here. Dr. Stephen Gundry, it's great to finally meet you, at least virtually.
Well, it's great to be on your program. This will be fun.
Excellent. I'm sure it will. And I just actually read your book, The Plant Paradox, a little belatedly in the last day or so. And I must say it's excellent. In the first half, I just carried along nonstop up until I got to plans and that. And nearly every aspect resonates with me, I'll have to say. There's one slight thing that's quite controversial of late, and that's around the need to reduce meat. But we might touch on that as we discuss APOE4 people and your extensive experience with APOE4s with inflammatory disease.
Sure. Yeah, that'd be great.
Great stuff. So APOE4, I work for Irish Heart Disease Awareness, and the founder, David Bobbitt, is an APOE3E4. I'm E3E4, my wife is too, and my first of five children I tested was double E4. So a lot of E4 going on.
Yeah.
And David Bobbitt had extensive heart disease discovered through a calcium scan. He then discovered he was diabetic type 2, and then discovered as he learned and researched that he was APOE4. And I think it was Bill Davis's Curality website, Track Your Plaque. He met a lot of other E4s, and they had huge discussions on their sensitivities from a dietary standpoint, especially when they've already sustained metabolic disease. And maybe that's one of the conditions to be very sensitive. But maybe if you could go through the kind of the history of APOE4, the genotype, and kind of what it means.
Well, I got interested in it as a cardiothoracic surgeon because APOE4s definitely have an increased risk of developing coronary artery disease, cerebral vascular disease. And as a part of being a surgeon and wanting to have these people not visit me subsequently after I did a coronary bypass on them, I became very interested in why this particular gene was so mischievous in producing cardiovascular disease. And I then morphed into, well, this is not just cardiovascular disease, this is brain issues, which became predominant. And through the years of working with dietary manipulation of prevention of the consequences of the APOE4 gene, I guess I became famous or infamous in the dietary treatment of this problem. Subsequently, I've gotten to know Dale Bredesen very well. We actually communicate frequently. I think Dale is really the number one expert at the cellular level, even genetic level, of why the APOE4 allele is so mischievous. And, you know, the two of us kind of crosstalked. It's a funny story. We met years ago and we had never met each other, and we were introduced, and he says, oh my gosh, you know, I'm such a big fan of yours. And I went, really? You know, I'm a really big fan of yours. And so we've hit it off ever since.
Yeah, I interviewed Dale. He was kind enough to invite me to his home north of San Francisco when I was over at a CrossFit function in December. So we had a great discussion on Alzheimer's and certainly touched on E4, but didn't go into a whole lot of depth. But we covered it somewhat. So this is great.
Yeah, you know, Dale and I have, I guess, differing ideas of, you know, the benefit or the problem with this gene. I think we both agree that there probably are no bad genes. The gene evolved, most 20, 30% of people don't carry this gene because it's bad. It had a physiologic purpose. Excuse me. Just like, for instance, there's another gene that produces the worst cholesterol, which is called lipoprotein little A, and it's sometimes called the Irish gene, sometimes called the Scottish gene, sometimes called the English gene. Interestingly, people who carry the ApoE4 have a very strong prevalence of carrying the LP little A gene that makes this little particle of cholesterol with a corkscrew. And it people don't know, because doctors don't traditionally test for it, that LP little A is absolutely the number one risk factor for developing coronary artery disease and familial heart disease, aortic stenosis, and what's called vascular dementia. That's different from Alzheimer's dementia. But the two often coexist. And so your listeners who are ApoE4s, please, please, please make sure your physician orders a lipoprotein little A blood test. It's $8 in the United States. It's cheap. And I know you can get it in England, because in the British Isles, because I have a lot of patients in the British Isles who carry LP little A, and we can get it measured over there.
Actually, I have a disclosure there. Yeah, I'm extremely high LP little A as well. I think around 80 nanomole, so way up there. Interestingly, I have a zero calcium score at middle age. And I think Arthur Agatston, who I interviewed a couple of months ago in Miami, he was kind of saying it's a very strong risk factor, and it highlights a susceptibility on top of ApoE4. But sometimes he has people in their 70s with ultra clean arteries with high LP little A, and sometimes the opposite, obviously. So it's hard to know exactly when it's really going to strike or when it might not be a factor in your particular physiology.
Yeah, there's even some suggestion that, you know, when you look at a cohort of super old, super healthy people in their mid-90s, late-90s, early-100s, that carrying LP little A might be protective of getting into old age. So there seems to be this kind of gamut that you have to run through with LP little A, because I see, quite frankly, a ton of people, particularly families who have early, you know, strokes, heart attacks in their late 40s, early 50s, or early aortic stenosis in their 50s or 60s, for instance, and LP little A is often the causative factor. But you're right, you know, we're learning something new every day, and we'll on ApoE4s, hopefully we'll talk about some of the new stuff that's coming out with ApoE4s.
Great, yeah, absolutely. And I think ApoB or particle count is similar, and familial hypercholesterolemia, certainly earlier events, earlier issues, and then a large proportion of them can be, recently we had three people in their 60s with familial hypercholesterolemia with super high LDL for life and clear calcium scans and angiograms. So I sometimes wonder how much of these are indicating you are a certain genetic type with a strong susceptibility, and how much of these kind of quantities are directly causal in a general sense. But anyway, we'll get back to the E4 maybe.
Well, yeah, just a comment about that. I quite frankly could care less about LDL cholesterol. I could care less about ApoB. If you like the cholesterol theory of heart disease, and people should understand it is a theory, not a bad one. If you like that theory, then I think most of us would agree that it's the small dense particles of LDL that we should be interested in. And we have to be interested in whether those oxidize, whether they go rancid or not. Because I think all of us will agree that where the rubber meets the road, if your cholesterol doesn't oxidize, then you really can't start the cascade of plaque development. And I manage people with LDLs in the 200s, 300s, 400s, and quite frankly, they don't oxidize their small dense particles. And quite frankly, you know, God bless them, and I watch them with, you know, amused interest. We have to understand that I think the inflammatory theory of heart disease, even the autoimmune theory of heart disease, which I've promulgated recently and had two papers at the American Heart Association presented in the past year about that, and even the infectious theory of heart disease, that heart disease and carotid disease and even brain disease comes from an altered oral microbiome and an altered, what Dale Bredesen and I call, leaky mouth, which is similar to leaky gut. So having said that, I think if you don't attack your endothelial surface with a macrophage, an immune attack against it, or if you don't have organisms that have the capability of setting up biofilms on the surface of your blood vessels, then I don't really care if you have a very high LDL cholesterol. And we can measure these things. We can measure whether you produce what's called LPPLA2, which, to go down the nerdy thing, is basically a tractor beam that pulls oxidized LDL into the vasculature. And if you have a low LPPLA2, have a nice time with your LDL. So.
Yeah, and actually, I remember a really lovely study with LPPLA2 and LPA, and they crossed them on a stacked graph. And for people with low LPPLA2, they could have as high an LPA as they wanted and no risk increase. And then with higher levels of LPPLA2, the LPA had a dramatic kind of dose response increase. So it kind of, it speaks to exactly what you say there.
Yeah, so in my clinics, we look at this every 3 months and in every one we measure. And years ago, I actually wrote a paper about the factors that influence LPPLA2 and found that polyphenols and olive oil and fish oil dramatically lower LPPLA2. And if people stopped those, then LPPLA2 levels would rise into the dangerous range. And then when we re-added these polyphenols, which were grapeseed, at that time it was grapeseed extract, pycnogenol, which is French maritime tree bark, and then fish oil. And so these are manipulable factors with diet, which gets us back to the original question about manipulable factors of ApoE4s. How's that? Yep.
Absolutely. Perfect circling back. That's great stuff, Dr. Gundry. So yeah, the ApoE4 then, I suppose the basics would be, as per the plant paradox, to be extremely careful with all the inflammatory problems, lectins, hormone disruptors and everything. And I guess lower carb and certainly resolving or addressing diabetic dysfunction would be a big one for ApoE4s, particularly you have an issue when they come to you. So yeah, maybe go through the dietary. I shouldn't have summarized it there actually, but the general dietary intervention for ApoE4s, and in this case with a problem. So an existing metabolic issue or heart issue, and you're actually treating them and trying to resolve their problem.
Yeah, and I don't want to paraphrase Dale Bredesen, but one of the things that I think really helped me explain some of the mischief of the ApoE4 gene and its effect on patients is if we imagine that apolipoprotein E is one of the ways we carry cholesterol in the brain and deliver it to cells. We have to realize that there's nothing, again, intrinsically wrong with cholesterol. We need it for hormonal synthesis. We need it for cellular membrane synthesis. It's good stuff, but if I like the example I use, let's suppose that we're a passenger on a subway train, and the subway stops at a station, and we'll call that cells in the brain, and cholesterol, the passenger gets off, and it goes into the cell. At the end of the workday, the cholesterol, which is not used by the cell, should have the ability to get back on the subway and go off. What appears to be happening, and I think a lot of this is thanks to Dale Bredesen's work, cholesterol can get delivered to the cell, but when it's time for excess cholesterol to leave the cell, the subway doors are closed because of the effect of this gene. And so cholesterol, which would normally be cycled in and out of cells, isn't capable of coming out of the cell properly. And so from that simplistic view, cholesterol builds up in the cell with some of the problems that we see. So if that's where one of the defects is, it makes sense to me to limit as much as possible dietarily the things that are going to contribute to an elevated cholesterol level in ApoE4s. And through the years, I've found that saturated fats, particularly saturated animal fats, seem to be a real culprit in producing a higher level of small dense LDLs per person, if you will, in ApoE4s than if you carry the 3 or the 2 allele. And through the years, I found that if I could get people to, quite frankly, severely limit their cheese, that's one thing that goes a long way. And I like cheese, but there, I've had multiple occasions where we've withdrawn cheese, put it back in, measured small dense LDLs, measured oxidized LDL in fours and in other people. And in the fours, cheese is a big issue. Interestingly, early on in this, I used to laugh that if I asked people what their favorite food was and they would say cheese, invariably they would be in ApoE4. I call it to kryptonite to Superman. It's really actually kind of humorous that fours as a general group love cheese. The other thing I've found through the years is that coconut oil, which is a saturated fat, is also very responsible for increasing small dense LDLs in the fours. I haven't made up my mind about MCT oil, which is a medium chain saturated fat. It appears to behave differently. So I haven't banned it from my ApoE4 folks, but I'd be cautious with even MCT oil, but certainly coconut oil and saturated animal fats. One of the interesting things early in my work and others was the finding that there are sterols in shellfish that actually lower cholesterol, and everybody's told to avoid shellfish because it raises your cholesterol. These were actually based on reports when we couldn't tell the difference between sterols and cholesterol. And the sterols in shellfish will actually reduce, at least in my patient population, cholesterol numbers. So I actually, if people are going to eat animal protein, I steer them towards shellfish, particularly bivalves, clams, oysters, scallops. And if we have the time, we'll talk about why that may be very important in the ApoE4s.
That's great. Thanks, Stephen. Well, just to parse out what you said there a little, if I can summarize it. So the ApoE4s, I guess, in your case, they've got issues maybe a higher risk population or people with problems. So you want to particularly hone their diet. It's probably not like an ApoE4 who's completely healthy with a zero calcium score. They may have huge bandwidth to take a lot of foods in. But on the saturated fat then, one question I had was, has the cheese been teased out from, say, the meat? Because a ribeye steak actually certainly has saturated fat, but it's got a lot of mono. And as a percentage of the steak, there's not actually a huge amount of fat in there, really. Whereas cheese is really dense, fatty material, delicious. And along with the cheese question, I wonder about what you raised in your book, the casein A1, A2. So can we separate out for ApoE4s who respond negatively the cheese from, say, just meat, and then maybe look into the A1, A2 question? Is that part of why cheese is so deleterious maybe in some E4s?
Well, I think cheese is amazing source of saturated fat. It's incredibly concentrated. So I think that's a part of the puzzle. You're right. There are a number of monounsaturated fats in beef. Stearic acid is probably the highest component of fat in beef. Interestingly, I personally have tried huge amounts of stearic acid, which is the number one fat in chocolate, oh, by the way. And I can raise my total cholesterol, my LDL cholesterol, my small dense LDLs dramatically by eating stearic acid, which is supposed to be benign. At least in me, it's not. And I'm not a four, by the way. So some of this idea that animal consumption, if it's stearic acid, it's okay for you. I think the bigger question, at least from a longevity standpoint, is the contribution of the amino acid profile in animal protein versus the amino acid profile in plant protein, which activates mTOR receptors. And I spend a lot of time talking about that in the Longevity Paradox, my bestseller on longevity. So getting back to A1 and A2 milk, cows in Northern Europe about 2,000 years ago suffered a spontaneous genetic mutation where normally cows make casein A2. These cows started making casein A1. They're hardier, they give more milk, so that most of the cows now in the world are casein A1, including Ireland. You guys have Holsteins. And Holstein's the classic casein A1 cow. In fact, to say nothing about Irish butter, I tell my patients that there is a picture of a Holstein cow on a very popular grass-fed butter from Ireland, and I tell my patients that the company is trying to warn you that that's the wrong breed of cow. But however, in butter, there is actually very little casein left over, but ghee, the protein casein is removed from butter, so ghee is a much safer choice. But getting back to saturated fat, again, I think, at least based on 10,000 patients that I've studied with the four, saturated fats, like butter, like cheeses, are best limited. Does that mean you can't have them? No. And we do this kind of individually. Let me tell you a humorous story. I have a young man in his 40s whose father is a four, developed early onset Alzheimer's in his 60s, and the son is obviously very concerned. And he loves cheese, just loves it. And every time I would see him, every 3 months, his small dense LDLs were very high, his oxidized LDL was very high. And I said, look, you see what's happening with your dad, you want to avoid this, let's give up cheese. Okay, just humor me. And he wouldn't. Finally, I said, I'll tell you what, give up cheese for 2 weeks before the next blood test. Just 2 weeks, you can do it. He said, okay, yeah, you're right. I can do that for 2 weeks. Comes back, his small dense LDLs plummet. His oxidized LDL is now normal for the first time in several years. And he looks at it and he says, wow, it's the cheese. And I said, yeah, you know, light bulbs go out. Great, you get it. And he says, you know, this is great news. I said, oh, you know, thank goodness we're getting through. He said, I just have to give up cheese for 2 weeks before every blood test, and you'll never know.
Yeah, that, not an engineer there. But, just a quick break to remind you that this podcast is only possible due to funding from David Bobbitt and the Irish Heart Disease Awareness Charity. For middle-aged people, it is imperative to find out your heart attack risk by getting a CT scan of the heart and your CAC score. The new IHDA.ie website has all the scan resources. Please support us by visiting and sharing widely. Knowing your score, you can take action to stop the disease process and save your own life. It can even be as simple as removing sugar, refined carbs, and seed oils, i.e. processed food, from your diet. And now we return to the conversation. And I guess he adds to the large amount of observational information that essentially the cheese is tracking strongly. It seems, Stephen, that the cheese is kind of the real hot spot. The meat is maybe less clear, though you did mention the stearic acid. And you mentioned mTOR. Myself and Dr. Gerber in our book had a chapter on protein and the mTOR question. And we kind of stayed on the fence on mTOR because the worst thing for mTOR activation is to be insulin resistant, and we were more focused on that rather than meat protein. But meat protein, in your book, you go through the new 5GC and AC, and it's certainly work that's emerging. In engineering, I always look to black swans. So, for instance, if you take the Maasai, they were meat and milk and blood, basically. They were the screaming case of too much meat. But from all the autopsy analysis, no heart disease, no inflammatory problems. And then the Hong Kong are the highest meat eaters in the world with the highest longevity currently. So I wonder, why are there such black swans around meat? Or do you have to mix meat with some other modern processed foods to make a kind of offensive cocktail, I wonder?
Well, yeah, I think that's, again, getting back to what, you know, where does coronary artery disease come from, and whether it's immunological or inflammatory. I mean, at least now most people would admit that statin drugs work, not by lowering LDL cholesterol, but they work by switching off receptors for inflammatory activation. And that's how they work. So if you have, for instance, if you have an animal that's eating what it's supposed to eat and it's not fed GMO soybeans and wheat, and you don't have an animal that's filled with lectins, believe it or not, and doesn't have inflammatory fat profile, has a lot of omega-3 fats versus omega-6 fats, then I think the inflammatory contribution to, say, the new 5GC problem or the new 5AC problem becomes mitigated. But if you have new 5GC meat and an inflammatory profile that turns on your inflammation and you have insulin resistant, that's a recipe for disaster. But you're right. So if you tease out, okay, which of these is the important factor, we're worldwide now in a perfect storm of everything's wrong.
We surely are, Stephen. It's crazy. Sometimes I'm just, even after 7 or 8 years in this sphere, I'm amazed at the figures. It's frightening. A recent study, I think 88% of adult Americans did not have any single metabolic disease indicator. So basically only 12%,
the other way around.
No. had no me. And I looked at the data recently from NIH, and it looks like 64% of adult Americans over 45 are actually pre-diabetic or diabetic, and probably a lot more if you measure them properly like you do. So it's kind of crazy. But that theme, yeah, I guess because the new 5GC, you know, paleoanthropology, every other science would say we evolved from accessing meat and scavenging and all. So it would seem funny if it was independently, inherently problematic. But I recently saw a paper on APOE4.info, and it was fascinating because they had APOE4s with hypertension tracked. And what they found was that the APOE4s versus 2 and 3, if they had hypertension, they had a racked up risk of cardiac disease. And bizarrely almost, the APOE4s with no hypertension or metabolic issues had an actual relative lower risk in general than the E2s and E3s. So I guess it speaks to the huge interaction with the environment, or our modern toxic environment, as you mentioned.
Yeah. You know, I have the pleasure of taking care of lots of fours, and I have a number of 3-4s in their mid to late 90s now. I have a gentleman who's a 3-4 who is 97 years old. He still runs his company. He has 3 daughters that will not let him retire because he's so good at it. And I've been working with him for about 10 years now. And he's just a delight because, you know, anyone who will listen, this carrying the 4 is not a death sentence to your brain. It is not a death sentence to your coronary arteries. But I think you have to understand that there's things you should manipulate. I've got several 4-4s now in their mid to late 80s. I was taught is impossible. And if you look at the curves, you will say that there's no way 4-4 will ever get to 85 without Alzheimer's. And that is not true in my experience. So, do you have to work at this? Yes.
I'm not too surprised to hear that. I know I said, wow, but it makes sense if someone is doing everything right that they can achieve their evolutionary potential or status. But that means avoiding a hell of a lot of the modern environmental problems, just as laid out in your book and elsewhere. And also recently I sent a paper actually to Dale a few weeks ago. And of course he had it already, which I mentioned in the email. You probably have this already. But it was the Samain analysis, and they found that the APOE4s in Bolivia, the Samain people, E4s actually had, if anything, an advantage in terms of neurological decline, but specifically when they're living ancestrally in that community. And I think we've seen this elsewhere as well, with E4 can have advantages, but the caveat is not with a Western lifestyle.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And you know, Dale proposes that the E4 evolved to handle the inflammatory challenges of a paleo diet, if you will. I come at it slightly differently than Dale, but we certainly have a good time talking about this. I think the recent work looking at the effect of a different phospholipid profile in people with Alzheimer's disease, and I'm going to speak a lot to that in my next book. We know, for instance, that people with Alzheimer's, and quite frankly, a number of those people are 4s, have dramatically reduced plasmalogens, a type of phospholipid common in shellfish, in their brains compared to normals. And there's a fascinating small study out of Japan supplementing people with cognitive impairment with plasmalogens from scallops, in this case, and they are memory improved. So, I happen to think that rather than chasing animals out on the plains, we evolved by eating fish and shellfish. And that's whether you like that theory or not. Lane Morgan from the UK actually popularized that idea many years ago, and I happen to think she's right. So I think if you're four, getting a lot of phospholipids in your brain is very important. And Dale, there's several papers that Dale and I talk about that one of the problems with the ApoE4 is that normally DHA, incredibly important component of fish oil, which makes up about 50% of our brain, isn't carried into our brain properly by the apolipoprotein 4. You can bypass that problem by krill oil, which contains large amounts of these phospholipids and plasmalogens. And I think, quite frankly, anyone with four ought to be taking krill oil in addition to fish oil or other omega-3s. And there's now been a couple of papers that show how effective phospholipids are in getting what's missing into the four's brain that's necessary. And that's an easy fix. So anytime anybody is a four in my clinic, first thing I do is go get some krill oil. Have a nice day.
Yeah, and as you say, it's easy, and especially for someone who may have susceptibilities or demonstrated disease, you got to hit all the Pareto items, and there's an easy-to-do one. The science is solid, and it really is the personal responsibility of the person to do these things. I think a lot of it comes down to that. Some people are not too bothered following through, and that's a big challenge. On the shellfish, yeah, I had a paper years ago about the Neanderthals and how they went extinct. And it was kind of pointing out that the humans, Homo sapiens, were excellent fishers, and the ancient campsites had fishing equipment, but the Neanderthals were never able to do that. And that was one of the reasons they were behind. So I think we probably ate everything that moved for long phases of history, but shellfish, DHA, EPA, they're all really important for people to get. And I think, Stephen, years ago, decades ago even, my parents, cod liver oil was viewed very highly. Now, I know it's not specialized like krill, but in principle, and that's faded away. We have a pharmaceutical society now that frowns on supplements, that frowns on anything but things with a patent. You know, that's really the way the world has gone, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's really a shame. I actually... when I lived in London during my training in children's heart surgery at Great Ormond Street, I've got some old medical textbooks from the late 1800s. And in the back of one of the textbooks, which I still have hiding up here someplace, there's a whole chapter on the miracle of cod liver oil, on affecting rheumatism, on affecting depression, on affecting cognition. And, it was a miracle, and it was added into the textbook. It was brand new. And, yeah, I think if you actually look how mankind came out of Africa, we came following shorelines. And even there's actually some pretty good evidence in the Far East that we were boat fishermen 40,000 years ago, and on boats. And we weren't just wading into the water. We were pretty doggone good fishermen. So, and that, again, for fours, get yourself some shellfish, have some fish. It won't hurt you.
Certainly. And on the whole E4 thing, then, people who have sustained disease, and I get asked the question all the time, there may be debates around all of what we're saying. And, the world is changing. We have an emerging carnivore movement now, and even some E4 carnivores who are showing beautiful blood work back to me. And then there's the other extremes that we see, of course, vegan. So there's all these different factions and controversies. But I think the way David Bobbitt, my sponsor, views it is that we can't get all the answers, but if you're E4 and you have a high calcium score and you have known disease, you're kind of a special group and you've got to err on the side of safety. So it may be okay for a young E3 or even completely healthy E4 to eat any and everything. Now, obviously not modern processed foods, but all meats, fish, eggs, everything. But he feels strongly that the subgroup of E4 who have sustained disease or a high risk, you know, the right thing to do is err on the side of every nuance, you know, take the krill oil, avoid excessive meats, certainly avoid cheese. And that's a very logical approach, I think, for me when I'm challenged about, are we sure it's the meat? Well, look, if you're really healthy and your bloods are excellent and you're eating a load of meat, you can keep doing it. But we're talking about a special group of people, right? I mean, that's the core.
Yeah, and there are, you know, there's certainly people who a carnivore diet is the if you did it right, is the ultimate elimination diet. And many of my fans became aware of me because I was telling people that, hey, plants in general don't like you, and they've got a tremendous defense mechanism against you. And you know, the extreme of that is, oh, Dr. Gundry's right, plants hate me and I'm not going to eat them anymore. But it's an elimination diet. I think I don't get into these wonderful arguments, but you can ferment animal protein. You get a set of bugs that are very capable of fermenting animal protein. And the fact that you do not need fiber to produce butyrate, you can ferment animal protein into butyrate. You can. I'll have more to say about that soon. You also produce some other interesting fermentation products that probably in excess are not very good for you, such as hydrogen sulfide. I think a carnivore diet for a limited period of time to stop the inflammatory process in your gut is okay. Do I personally think it's a great idea long term? No, but you know, we could have a debate about that all day long, and we've had people on my podcast to do that. But so,
no. In fairness, David, though, I don't want to go down that hole. Best not. Interestingly, as you mentioned there, I'm sure your book, The Plant Paradox, I'm more than sure. I did see some fuss a while back. I'm not sure vegans and people from the very strongly plant biased world were that happy with it, even though you essentially end up with a flexitarian diet. Type diet, you know, I don't think they were happy to vilify the plant foods so much, even though you're absolutely correct in every example. So how was that? Did you get a lot of pushback?
Yeah, you know, it's funny that when I wrote the book, I basically said, you know, look, this is actually a secret vegan manifesto. I'm what I call a veg aquarian. My wife and I eat mostly vegan during the week, and then we have wild shellfish along with our plants on the weekends. But I have a vegetarian and vegan option on all my recipes in all my books. And that's, you know, I was a professor at Loma Linda University for most of my career, which is a blue zone. And my critics say, you know, what do you know about, you know, blue zones? Well, I'm the only nutritionist who's ever spent most of his career living in a blue zone, so I guess I know a little bit about it. But yeah, they were my fiercest critics. And all you got to do is actually read the book and you realize that I'm very pro plant predation. You know, but you got to know which ones have your back and which ones do not like you. And it's actually pretty simple.
Yeah, and as I read the book, Stephen, to be honest, that came across to me, my logic, so strongly. You're actually helping hugely someone who wants to be plant-based to do so optimally and safely. But I guess, you know, very strong-minded people who are plant-biased, they're probably uncomfortable with such a deluge of criticism of so many plant types. It feels like a very negative kind of experience for them. But I agree, read the book through and all is revealed. Dale actually talked about fiber, and it was interesting. His podcast was very popular, but because I'm followed by all types of people, there was a strong pushback on the fiber. If you eat lots of fiber, it's more okay to eat sat fat. Fiber is really good. Fiber is, you know, it's a very useful thing for Alzheimer's. So you get all these comments, and he was interested by all these negative comments just for promoting fiber. So you mentioned actually there fiber and fermenting or the biome, taking meat proteins and making short chain fatty acids. So maybe we'll circle back to that and talk through the fiber controversy, because I know you've got a hard stop. So the fiber.
So I think Dale and I actually would agree on this, that more and more the microbiome and its interaction with the gut wall and with our immune system that lines the gut wall. I mean, 60-70% of all of our immune cells are stationed lining the gut wall. And both he and I think that a great deal of amyloid is not produced in the brain, it's produced in the gut. And if you have a leaky gut, it is then loose to go to the brain. He and I both agree that glial cell, microglial cell activation is probably the fundamental problem in dementia, and that he and I think agree that that activation is caused by leaky gut and or leaky mouth, and that we should have the most diverse microbiome we can have. We should have fiber that produces butyrate. Butyrate is absolutely a miracle in sealing leaky gut, in giving the right fuel to mitochondria, particularly neuron mitochondria. And I spend a lot of time in the longevity paradox talking about how important butyrate is and as a signaling molecule, if nothing else. So most of what I try to do to get people to eat is the more things that you can eat that will allow your gut microbiome to produce butyrate, the better. And so I'll back Dale on that. Having said that, when I started researching to have some ammo against carnivore diets, lo and behold, there are a set of bacteria that are perfectly happy with fermenting animal protein into butyrate. So, oh well.
Excellent. And again, I haven't gone down into this sphere so much, so that's interesting to hear. I'd heard talk of it before, but I never had the bandwidth in my current role to be really going researching that. So that's excellent to hear that. And I guess the Maasai and many other populations with a lot of meat, they had loads of those critters in there, which would have naturally occurred over generations.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, it takes a while to get a microbiome that is capable of eating the things you eat. I mean, for instance, just as a funny aside, the Japanese really only have the only microbiome in the world that's capable of digesting the cell wall in seaweed. And they picked up that microbiome by eating raw fish that happened to have the bacteria still in the guts, and they seeded that their population. So they're actually the only proven population that has a microbiome that can digest seaweed.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I always felt that the microbiome is massively important. I've interviewed people, and I agree myself, and it's in your book, that the leaky gut and the junctions are kind of the root of most modern chronic disease. So agree with all of that. And the biome, I always felt that rather than transplanting biomes, I know that's beginning to happen and maybe can help you. It seems like the wrong way. It's like pharmaceutical rather than supplements or DHA. It's like transplanting biomes rather than fixing what goes in your mouth and letting the biome evolve.
Correct.
So Do you think there's a place, though, maybe for someone to do both for supercharge? I mean, change everything and then also introduce an element of an appropriate biome? Could that be happening at some point?
Yeah, I mean, there's some, you know, fascinating work with autistic kids, giving them crapsules, as they're called, and showing that their symptoms of autism improve 50% by giving them crapsules from healthy donors. The problem has been, certainly in the United States, the FDA has taken a dim view of this because you can certainly transmit microbiomes that you don't want, even from healthy people. I agree with you that for most people, you actually have in the crypts of the microvilli a nice little collection of the important microbes that are there. They are suppressed by the modern world diet by a bunch of bad bacteria. And the bad bacteria like simple sugars and they like saturated fats, and that's our diet. So they kind of crowd out all the other guys. But if you starve the bad guys, eliminating simple sugars and saturated fats, and give the good guys what they like, which happens to be resistant starches and fibers, soluble fibers, not resistant fibers, they'll come out and they'll start to grow. And so you're right. I much prefer having people eat what we know that these bacteria like. And I talk about it in all my books. Give them what we know they like and everything will be fine.
Yeah. And you grow your own biome over a period of time, eating the right foods, and generate your own health, as was pointed out in your book, that it's not so much what's driving bad health, what's holding back your body from repairing and regenerating. And it's always going to be a specific component. And overwhelmingly, that component or many components are going to come in from your environment through your mouth. That's where the root causes get fixed. So, hey, delighted with this conversation now, and especially to have something very much around E4. You know, that's something I've wanted to get together for some time, and no better man, as we say in Ireland, than yourself. I'm conscious we have a slot. And is there anything else you think we should cover just before we come to a close?
No, I think that's a lot of information to soak in. Recently, I was at a dinner at an organic farm in Southern California, and the son had inherited the farm from his father, and was telling us about his father, who I knew. And his father said, I think, something very profound that alludes to what you just said. And the father told his son, he said, "Son, what we do is we feed the soil, not the plant." And when I've told people to, you know, eat for your bacteria, not for you. And Jack LaLanne, you know, the godfather of fitness, who made it to 96, and he'd still be alive if he had taken antibiotics for his pneumonia, but that's another story. So he always said, if it tastes good, spit it out. Now, my people say, will you stop repeating that? Because people think that you're telling people to eat food that tastes bad. I said, no. He actually was trying to tell you that you should be eating for them rather than for this 2x3-inch piece of muscle in your mouth. And I think I think that the only purpose of food is to get olive oil into your mouth, quite frankly. And to me, plants are a really good way to do that.
Yep. Very good. That's great, Stephen. And I guess I heard a phrase once, it just occurs to me as you were speaking there, a cardiologist who's really excellent. He made the comment about ApoE4s who have inflammatory markers that respond negatively to various diets. The phrase was, fish should be his meat. which I thought was a nice way of putting it. So there may be huge amounts of humans, the vast majority perhaps, who can eat good pastured meat, absolutely no problem. But again, this point that if you're ApoE4 and you have disease and you're at risk, you know, vector towards the safest possible kind of selection of foods, all whole foods, no processed food, and maybe keep in mind the sensitivities that we discussed here today.
And have a few raw oysters. What the heck?
Yeah, really tie one on. Hey, thanks a lot, Stephen. That's great stuff. We might circle back, a little down the road after your next book.
That'd be great. Yeah, the next book is called The Energy Paradox. It'll be out next fall. And kind of why nobody's got any energy anymore.
Yeah, that's a major problem today. So I'll look out for that and I'll grab a copy as soon as it's available. Thanks a lot, Stephen.
Thank you, Ivor.
Thanks for tuning in, guys. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see my subscribe button in the middle of the screen, a free viewing of the Widowmaker movie on the far right, and myself and Dr. Gerber's book, Eat Rich, Live Long, on the left. Otherwise, please do subscribe to the audio podcast. Thanks.